Chats, the show where I, Josh Pigford, founder of Baremetrics, hop on a call with my founder pals and get the stories of how they started and grew their businesses. This week, I talk with Michael Pryor of Trello. We talk about learning to code from computer magazines, working in a grocery store freezer, co-founding Fog Creek 17 years ago, coming up with the Trello concept, getting acquired for a huge sum of money, what it's like working at a public company now, and so many other things. I hope you enjoy it. All right. Hey, Michael, thanks for hopping on the call.
Hi, Josh. Thanks for having me.
So you're in New York, is that right?
I am. I'm looking at the Statue of Liberty right now.
All right, right on. Is that from your office you can see the Statue of Liberty?
Yep.
Well, that's good. That's a good view. So are you from New York?
So this is an interesting question, because how long do you have to live somewhere before you can say that you're from there, right?
We'll say 22 years.
I'm getting there. Pretty close. Okay. I grew up in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and then I went to school at Dartmouth up in New Hampshire. And then after school, so when I graduated from college, I moved to New York. And so that was in 1998.
Okay. Gotcha. So you graduated from Dartmouth in 1998, is that right?
Yep. And then I moved straight to the city, and I've been there ever since. I was only supposed to be here for a year, but, you know, that's what happened. Yeah, exactly.
All right, cool. So I'd like to touch on that. I'd love to hear your story pre-Trello, like way back, like when you were a kid. What were you up to?
You know, I don't know if you know, but they used to send out magazines that had computer code in them. So this is how I first got interested in computers. And I didn't know anything about the code or what it meant, but I realized that if I typed all those letters without any errors into the computer, then into my TI-99 at the time, then cool stuff would happen.
Yes.
Right? So, and the worst part was, I didn't actually know how to use an editor, so it was just, the command line, and I'm typing these basic commands. So if at any point in time I didn't even know, how to fix if I had done a typo, so it was I really had to type, the entire thing without error. So I started playing with computers very early on, playing computer games, all that kind of stuff. And when I went through high school, I had a bunch of jobs. I worked as a busboy for a while at a deli place, and I realized that I made my tips as a percentage of the waitress's tips, and so I wasn't getting paid that much because the checks for a deli are not that high. So then I went to become a busboy at this fancy pants restaurant that was out in the country, because the waitresses made a lot more money because the checks were a lot higher, so then I made more money. So then I became a waiter out there. And then I got this job that paid really well, but it was in a freezer. It was like a grocery wholesaler. And so all the trucks would come in and put all the food in to a refrigerated warehouse and a freezer warehouse, and they paid you extra to work in the freezer warehouse because you had to wear a suit and full body suit and gloves, and it was
like freezing all day.
Yeah, but it was middle of summer, but you're freezing all day. Sure. So I did that job, and I was in high school over the summer, and I was working with these adults that were working this job, and that was their life. Job, that was their career. And I basically decided I do not want to do a manual labor job for the rest of my life. I better study really hard and do well in school, because I was just looking at the struggle that these people went through, and it was not fun. So I went to college, and I actually, at that point, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I worked in the dining hall for a while, and then I also delivered newspapers. I had to get up super early, and I would skateboard around campus. I was the only person skateboarding around New Hampshire campus. It was really weird at the time. But then I discovered that there was a job at the computing center to do computer support. And that was ringing this bell in me. It was hey, that's a cushy job, right? I don't have to scrape dirty food off dishes or get up at 5 in the morning to deliver newspapers. So I went over and I told the woman who ran the computing center, I was I don't really have that much experience with Macs. The whole campus was Mac at that time. And but I'm a really hard worker, and like I'll do a great job, and you know, and she gave me the job, and I basically just learned as I went, and started taking computer science courses, and one thing led to another. You know, then I graduated from school in '98 and came to the city to work at a startup called Juno, which was a startup that was going to compete with AOL. So AOL charged you $20 a month to get your email, and we were going to give it to you for free, but we were going to sell advertising. We were going to make money off of advertising, but give you the...
Like the email client.
Yeah,
I totally remember that.
Right, so I was a programmer, and I wrote code on the Windows client that was the Juno application. Funny story, that was actually a project that was done by a hedge fund called D.E. Shaw. And David Shaw, this guy in New York, he had a bunch of money, and the internet was kind of hot at the time, and so he had smart people working for him. And one of the guys had this idea for Juno to compete against AOL. This other guy had this idea. He was like, I think selling things on the internet is going to be a really big deal, so maybe we should sell stuff on the internet. We'll make like a store on the internet. Maybe we'll sell books. Right. And I think David was like, I might give you some money, but I'm not really excited about that. That doesn't seem like a very exciting business. So Jeff Bezos went and did his own thing. And
some very, very minuscule success story.
Yeah, right, right. And Juno, you know, kind of like just floundered. It was actually, we went public. Juno went public. And it was one of the first IPOs that closed lower than its opening price. So the day before we went IPO, you basically went around the office, and there was all these like kids there. Basically, I was one of them, and it was ridiculous because we're sitting there thinking, "Wow, you know, I'm we're gonna open at $11, and we'll probably close our stock price. We'll close at $111, you know, on the first day, because that was happening. Like these, it was ridiculous." And so you're like, okay, so I'll work for a couple years, and then I'll retire, right? Like, it was so crazy. And immediately, like, your dreams are dashed, like, a day later because, like, the stock goes down. In fact, the only money I ever made was after I quit. I bought puts and bet on the price tanking, and it did. So I made a couple grand.
So, I mean, like, the emotional roller coaster from thinking you're about to be, you know, like a millionaire or something. I assume you played the like what if game on the stock, on the share price.
Yeah, totally, totally. Of course. You're like, you know, the first thing I'm gonna do is this, and then I'm gonna, you know, just relax and not do anything and travel the world. Or
what was like the tone in the office like as the day went on? Like, was everybody just like somber and
yeah, it was basically what it started. It changed the emotional tone, right? And it never really recovered because it also meant that it became harder to raise money. It became harder to run the company, right? So you were like people started getting laid off. And this was happening across every technology startup, right? Not just Juno. But that tide was shifting in 2000. And it was really starting to... It took a while, like it took a long time, but like first, you know, all the people that were English majors that were never working at startups, like they got laid off first, right? And the developers still had their jobs, right? So, but it wasn't as fun because we were working with all of our friends and some of them were now unemployed and hanging out at Starbucks. Although at that time, they like extended the unemployment for a very long time. And so it was actually, it was kind of like this extended vacation for a lot of people. But Joel, I met this guy, Joel Spolsky, a little bit older than me, had worked at Microsoft on Visual Basic for Excel. He was like a program manager on Excel and kind of came up with and implemented VBA for Excel. And he worked at Juno with me. And, you know, so we're kind of there and it wasn't very fun. And one summer, he and I said, like, why don't we just do our own thing? And I was kind of naive enough to think that I could do that, and I quit my job, and Joel quit his job, and we started sort of consulting at the time. Yeah. We started Fog Creek Software was the company, and we just, you know, we were trying to pay the bills, and so we were like, we'll do consulting, and then we'll build some software on the side, and one thing led to another, and we, you know, I don't know how much detail you want me to go.
So on the let's hop to Fog Creek there. So, you know, you've been doing Juno at IPOs, but that's sort of a downer, and everybody's getting laid off. I mean, is the reason that you start what's really just a consulting company, or maybe almost like a holding company to just do stuff? Why do that? Was it because of the sort of failed IPO or the lackluster IPO, or is it just the timing of that was sort of irrelevant?
Yeah, I mean, I think that gave us the impetus, right? Because it was like it gave you an opportunity to do something different. Mm-hmm. I don't think I ever set out with this mindset of like, I'm going to do my own thing and start my own company. I do have. I when I look back at my life, like I definitely had this naive mentality that I can kind of figure anything out, and also I'll just like go do it, even though I might not know how to do it. So like,
sure.
Like saltwater fishing, like I really, for some reason that got into my bones, and I was like, I'm gonna figure this out, and I figured out, you know, like. Went offshore 60 miles by myself and figured out how to catch tuna. Like, I don't know how I did that. Like, it was a lot of days where I just came back and had nothing, you know? But eventually, you know, you start to pick things up and you talk to the right people and you learn and you can figure it out. So I didn't set out to start a company. I think I just wanted to do something fun, and Joel was an awesome guy to work with, and we kind of were stuck in New York City, and it wasn't really a great place for software developers, right? Because at that time, Silicon Valley was the place to be.
Right.
And if you're in New York and you're a developer, it was, you know, Juno was cool, but it was really an ad company.
Yep.
So even though we were software developers, the business was seen as an ad business. And so we were, you know, just supporting the ad business. We were just building that little thing that shows the ads, right? That's how the company thought of us. And so we were like, hey, let's build a software company where the developers are the most important component of the company. And we're going to do that in New York because we don't want to move. And so we did. And, you know, in the beginning, it was kind of, you'd make, you know, we were just barely paying for one of our salaries. And in fact, we recorded Joel's salary but didn't pay him for a couple of years. I remember the day, it was probably like 4 or 5 years in, where we were able to back pay all of the salary that we had recorded for him. So that was pretty cool.
So you mentioned you guys do this sort of consulting thing or started this company, and part of that's because you just sort of have this figured out mentality. And I think, I mean, to me, that seems to be a pretty common trait among any founder or entrepreneur, really, is this ability to just, like, I don't have any clue what I'm doing, but I'll figure it out.
Yeah, it's like, it's almost like, it is a little bit of a naivety, right? Like, you're almost like, I can't be that hard.
Yeah.
Which is obviously false.
Like 10 years later, and you're just like,
exactly. Oh. But it lets you, like, just plow right into it, right? And you, because I think that so many things are overwhelming, but you look at it and you see another person doing it, and I guess maybe some of it is like, well, if they can do it, I can do it, or,
right.
You know, but like back in that day, like just simple things, like just accepting credit cards online for your software, to sell your software online, was like impossible. Like, I remember going to the bank and telling them, like, I want to sell stuff and, you know, accept people's credit cards. And they're like, oh, well, we'll have to come out and do a site visit, and you'll have to display these things on your retail establishment door. And I'm like, we don't actually.
There's no establishment.
Yeah, there's no. And they're, but they like couldn't figure that out. So, you know, like we just had to like hack the system and be like, okay, I guess we'll put them up on the door. And they gave us a credit card reader. Like, we had to get a credit card reader because they're like, yeah, there's a gateway where you can like send the credit cards over the internet, but you know, most of your business will probably be through this credit card reader. So yeah, there was all that stuff, and just discover it as we go, and just learn as we go. And there was no book you could read. Now it's great because there's like for every piece of running a business, you can just like sign up for a SaaS service to do it.
Right. Simplifies the whole thing. But I mean, yeah. I think the, you know, you think of somebody who goes to, say, business school or something. To me, there's something to be said of just not knowing, like the naivety that you mentioned, like just not realizing how difficult it can be, is really probably a good thing. And there's probably lots of companies that never would have gotten started had the people who started them known what on earth they were getting into.
Yeah, I think the problem that most humans get caught up in, and I do too, even sometimes, which is that you think that the hard part is the idea, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not. It's obviously the execution. It's like doing it day after day and failing and failing and failing and learning from your failing and then doing it again and doing it again. And it's only in hindsight when you look back over like a decade or 15 years, you're like, oh, wow, I did come a long way. But when you're doing it at the time, the amount of work that you have to put into it just seems like, ugh, I'm not making any progress, you know?
Yep. So you guys are doing consulting stuff, but at what point do you guys transition from the consulting part to actually building products?
Well, we always knew that like consulting doesn't scale. And so we wanted to just use it to bootstrap funding for selling software. Mm-hmm. We kind of were taking cues from what people were asking us to build and seeing if we could build something out of that. Actually, one of the first contracts we had was this company asked us to build. They had a bunch of HR people. It's a pretty big company. They had all these HR people. They were trying to put their HR ducks up on their website, but they needed the HR people to be able to update those docs really easily. Like, they basically need a content management system, but at the time, that wasn't really a thing. It kind of was, but it really wasn't at scale, you know, for consumers. And they also, everyone used PCs and there was no such thing as SaaS. So we built that for them, this app that was like a VB app, Visual Basic app. And then we sort of made it more generic to be a content management system that we called CityDesk. Because we thought that, you know, people were going to be putting a lot more stuff online. And the real blocker was that most people weren't technical, so they didn't know how to get the movable TypeScripts into CGI bin and Chmod 755, all the scripts so that, you know, they ran on the web server. It was like getting that set up was you had to be a developer to do it. And our thinking was, hey, we'll just make it really easy. People just need their FTP credentials. We'll write a desktop app that lets them add articles and then figures out all the HTML and then just uploads it. Right. So, and, you know, I mean, obviously the people that were building TypePad and Movable Type Blogger and all those kinds of tools at the time obviously saw that same issue when people were trying to install their tools and solved it by giving them a web page that somebody could click to basically use their software. And so that became a way better solution to the problem that we were solving. So that product, CityDesk, we actually sold a decent amount of it, but you know, it was like the right problem to solve at the right time, but it was the wrong implementation.
Gotcha.
So we also had some bug tracking software that Joel had written at some previous company and gotten the rights to. And we were like, yeah, we'll just throw it up on the website and sell that, you know, because we're developers and Joel's been writing some articles and developers are reading them and maybe we could sell them this developer tool. And, you know, people are using Bugzilla at the time and we were like, hey, buy this thing. And we stupidly named it Fogbugs with a Z because that was cool at the time. And, you know, that didn't like take off. Like, it's, you know, we made like $10 one day and like $50 a couple weeks later. And, you know, it was really slow. But over time, when you looked at it in hindsight, like it was growing pretty well and pretty fast.
Gotcha. You guys are doing consulting, but then you kind of start figuring out the product stuff, launch the bug tracking thing. And then it was like 2011 or so, Trello.
comes into the picture?
Yeah, so that we skipped like a whole decade. So wait, let me just cover that decade real quick. Yeah. So one thing that happened early on was actually we were making pretty good progress. We had these consultants. We're also building software. We had hired two people. We even had an intern at one point. We had hired two people, and then really the bottom dropped out of the market.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It really crashed. Like, it had been not doing great, but then it really crashed. And the first thing that everyone cut was outside contractors, right? Like, if you, mm-hmm. you know, that just saves money immediately. You're going to pay your employees before you pay people that aren't really working for you. So all of our revenue basically dried up. And we had just hired these two people, one of which his wife had just gotten pregnant. So it was actually like awful. It was the worst part. It was the worst period because we basically said to them, we went to them, we said, hey, we have enough money to pay you for another month, so you can start looking for a job now, or we could spend the month looking for more contracting gigs, and then, you know, that's like that'll all, like if we get one, then great, but if not, then that's it. And yeah. And so they were like, let's do it, let's look for the gigs, and we did it, and nothing came up, and then they left. And it was, we found both of them jobs with people that we had known, so it wasn't like, you know, the worst case scenario, but it was really sad. It was like a really sad right. moment, really depressing. Like I would come to work and it would just be me and Joel, and it was like starting from scratch, and we clawed our way back, you know, piece by piece. But really during that time we just focused on the software and building the software, and Joel was writing his articles and building up his brand, which was for us a really good marketing tool.
Yep.
In hindsight, it was, you know, the right marketing tool at the right time, but it also prevented us from doing traditional marketing. We never had to learn that muscle or that skill.
You're like defaulting to Joel.
Like all we knew was content marketing, right? Yep. And the only person that could do it was Joel. And, you know, it was like his voice, his style. So after a while, you know, when he kind of ran out of ideas to write about or wasn't as interesting to him, and there was nothing beyond that, right? Like what was our traditional marketing skills?
Yeah.
So over that 10 years, from like 2000 to 2010, we experimented with a lot of different things, but Fiveworks was really growing and was really the driver of a lot of our growth. But we did have this culture of like, hey, let's try new things. We built this app called Copilot, which was a screen sharing tool. We cobbled together with VNC at the time, and we used it because we saw a need to control other people's computers when we were trying to install fog bugs on their servers. Like, because they were trying to tell us what they saw on the screen, and it was really difficult. You're like, if I could just like take over their computer, like we saw this in 2 seconds. And so we wrote some scripts that did that on top of VNC and started selling it. And that was actually the right product at the right time, because LogMeIn and GoToMyPC didn't exist then. Mm-hmm. But we marketed it to customer support people or people helping their moms with their computers. Like the marketing was all wrong, right? If you look at what GoToMyPC did and LogMeIn. And also I think like we didn't invest enough to keep up with the tech to make sure that it was performant and really, you know, for us it was like, hey, we're making 30 grand a month. Like this is amazing, you know, and really we need to plow all that money back into the product in order to build $1 billion business. But there was $1 billion business opportunity there because those two other companies did it, but we didn't. So, you know, we made some money off of it, but that was, you know, kind of like not really a failure, but we learned some lessons there about marketing.
So at what point did you decide Copilot, which presumably of the products you had made thus far, that was the biggest success? Or
no, Fogbugs was
way bigger. Fogbugs was still, yeah. Had surpassed that. Okay, never mind.
Yeah, nothing ever reached the sort of pinnacle that Fogbugs had reached. That was always driving a lot of the rest of our projects.
Okay, gotcha.
Until like one day in 2010, Joel had this list of ideas. He had like a text file on his desktop that had all his ideas of things that we wanted to build someday. And he was talking to Jeff Atwood, who wrote a blog called Coding Horror. They were both kind of, you know, tech guys that had wrote websites that people followed. And Jeff, I guess, had left his job and was looking to do something new. And they were just chit-chatting. And Joel kind of pitched this idea to him because at the time there was this website called Experts Exchange. Mm-hmm. which, you know, always showed up in your Google answers, and it was like, if you knew this hack where you scroll all the way to the bottom, you could get the answer. Yeah, but it just, like, it drove programmers nuts, right? Like, yeah. It was awful. Like, it felt like such a scam. And so Joel had this pitch that he wanted to build something to replace that, and Jeff kind of got interested in that, and we sort of formed a little entity between Fog Creek and Jeff, although Jeff did most of the work, and Joel was sort of like the PM, I guess, and they would have these podcasts that they'd put out on how they were building it, and then Jeff brought in two of his friends, and we formed a little entity, and Stack Overflow was born, and took off. And it was funny, because in the early days, we were so accustomed to selling software that when StackOverflow.com took off, our first thought was, hey, we could sell this Q&A software to other people to run their own Q&A sites.
Yep.
And we sort of started doing that in beta, and had people. And it was kind of like when we look at the sites, they were just like ghost towns. And we realized that, like, the reason Stack Overflow succeeded was because Joel and Jeff brought their entire audience there on day one and created both the supply and the demand in the network, right? Like, that's the whole key. It wasn't really the software. It was the community that was so valuable. And that wasn't working out for these other people, and we realized that was kind of, like, not great. You know, you're going to sell this software to these people for $10 a month, and their sites are just going to be vBulletin sites or PHPBB. Sure, sure. Like, it was just a continuation of that. And at the time, Stack Overflow was pretty successful, so some VCs had found out about it, and Union Square Ventures came and talked to us a little bit and said, look, the value that you've created is this network of developers, not necessarily the software, and selling the software is really kind of not the direction that you want to go. Like, if you want to build these large sites, you have to nurture them and seed them, and so we canceled the selling Stack Overflow software business and spun Stack Overflow off into its own company and took VC for it.
And then ultimately, like, that kind of, I guess, spawned what, Stack Exchange? I mean, just the whole...
Right. So then it was like, hey, we built Stack Overflow as Q&A for developers. Like, let's see if we can build Q&A sites for adjacent things that those developers might be interested in. And, you know, we could spread out. We're sort of like cognizant of the fact that Yahoo Answers was this place where you could ask any question, and it just became a cesspool, right? Like, if there's no quality filter on the questions, and everyone can ask any question, it's a broken window, right? Like, it just makes the site feel like...
It will eventually end up at the bottom with just, like, the worst of the worst.
Yeah, and right. And so you have to have some rules around, like, what is allowed and what is not allowed. Like, the not allowed is actually just as important as what is allowed. And, you know, we also have learned that it's also important to be nice, right? Sure. Like, there can be rules, but you also have to be nice to people. And so that's an important component of it, too. But...
So what was your role in the Stack Overflow, Stack Exchange bit?
I was like the business guy. Like, I took care of the payroll and the sales tax and the QuickBooks. I just did all the operational stuff. I wasn't really product related. In fact, when we spun Stack off into its own company, I became the CFO and just, you know, did all the operational stuff. Gotcha. It was more like a COO, but I was... not just finance, but I don't really have a finance background, so I just had to learn it. It was that same thing again, where I'm like, I don't know what deferred revenue is, but I guess I need to learn. Yeah. And so I did that for a while, and eventually we kind of realized maybe we should hire somebody that has some real finance experience at some point. And so we did, and you know, it was fine. And also at that time, Fog Creek had been humming along and had built this Trello thing. And I'll tell you how that came about. So that was kind of interesting. So it was about so we started Stack Overflow in 2010. And in 2011, Joel had this idea for Trello. And the idea came about because we kept doing this thing in Fogbugs where we'd get all these cases, right, of things that we wanted to build. And then we, you know, like a year later, you'd realize you have this giant backlog of stuff you're never going to do, or it wasn't relevant anymore. And you just declare bankruptcy and you'd like close it all.
Sure.
And you're like, why did we do all that work to put all that stuff in there anyway? Like, the problem was that, like, there was no forcing function on the work that we put into the system to deal with it. We just saw it as this unending bucket that we could just keep adding to. And that created a cognitive load on us that didn't allow us to know exactly what we were working on. So it was, you know, we basically said, we were also managing a company that was kind of bigger at that point in time, and you're kind of trying to figure out, like, what, I mean, now we have this database, all this stuff, but what are people really doing? And you'd go in their office and you'd see they're writing code, so they were clearly doing stuff, but it wasn't clear how it fit in the strategy. So Joel, he comes up with this idea. He's like, okay, what we'll do is everyone have a to-do list, and it'll have five slots in it. And so you only get one to-do list. And so, Josh, you've got a to-do list. It's got five slots in it. I can see yours. You can see mine. And two of the items are things you're working on right now. Two of the items are things you're going to work on next. And one thing you're just never going to do, so don't even bother asking me to do this thing because I'm just not doing it. Yeah. And that was just like a random idea. And I thought at the time, I was like, this is a dumb idea. This is not a good idea. Like, I don't get it. And also because I think Joel wanted to call it Five Camels. or five things, or like it was something like I was like, and just as the more I thought about it, it was just not, I just like didn't get it. And the idea sort of, you know, switched around for a while, and some people played with it. And we were also looking at, you know, as developers, we were looking at there were a bunch of Kanban boards out there, and we had post-it notes up all over our walls and in our offices and all those kinds of things. So it was sort of this mishmash of like lists, but also post-it notes, which weren't really tasks. They weren't defined as tasks. They could just be whatever you wanted them to be. Yeah. And also, you know, trying to think about our marketing mistakes in the past where every time we kept building developer tools, and you know, at that point in time, like Atlassian was huge, and it was like, hey, can we build something even bigger than our current market? Because, you know, what's really exciting is to build a tool that, you know, 100 million people could use, right? Like, that would be so cool, but also so audacious and ridiculous. And all that stuff sort of swirled together in a pot, and that's how Trello was sort of born. Was it came out of this idea of, well, we're going to borrow from Kanban, but these are not, the cards are not tasks. They're just cards. You can use them for whatever you want. Just think of them like sticky notes. But also, there's not any kind of concept of, you know, dependencies or hierarchy or structure or, like, you're never going to see a Gantt chart in Trello because this thing is not built for developers. It's built for humans.
Yep.
Right. And so that was actually pretty tricky because early on we knew all the people that were going to use that tool were going to be developers. And every time we're going to hear feedback, it was going to be some feature request for some project management feature. And right. We were going to have to say, that's not really what we're building. I know that's 100% of the people that are using it today, but we hope someday we're going to have, you know, salespeople using it, marketing people using it, and people to plan their weddings and people using it for their little leagues. And it, you know, like, the idea was that it would give structure to any kind of process that you're working on. The code name for it was called Trellis, which is a structure for plants to grow on.
Yep.
And so that's how it came to be. And
was it hard to be kind of dogmatic about the, you know, obviously developers who can be vocal. Was it hard to have to constantly like push back and say like, yeah, that's a great idea, but we're not doing that.
Well, it's interesting because we put up a Trello board where we took feature requests and then you could vote on the cards, right? Because this is around the time that user voice was big and like sort of talking to your customer. And in the early days, I think that was very valuable because we had like a small set of people. But as time went on, that board actually became a really bad idea because what it did was it essentially told people, tell us what you want, and if you vote for it, we will be compelled to make it, right? which is not something we wanted to say. We were actually trying to say we have a vision for what we're going to try to build. We also want to hear from you, but actually what we want to hear is your story and your pain point, not your idea for how to fix it. Yep. Because we're trying to make something that works for you and for somebody that's nothing like you, right? And so you might come up with a feature that's going to fix your problem exactly, but really what we need to do is figure out a horizontal solution for everyone. And it might only fix 80% of your problem, right?
Sure.
So that eventually we took that board down because there would be these cards that had thousands of votes, right? Because it's just that number just keeps going up over time.
Sure.
And then the more things you don't do, those are the things that stick around. And then people start saying, this feature was requested 4 years ago and you didn't do it. And you're like, I did this to myself. Because I told these people to tell me what they wanted by giving them a tool that made it seem like that's what I wanted. And it's not what I wanted. What I wanted is to have conversations with people and figure out their pain point. And I'll tell you one example of a story that comes into that. So one thing people kept asking for was they wanted to be able to mark a card as done. Mm-hmm. Okay, because they're coming from this project management world, and most of the boards they have cards which are tasks, and they're like, I want to mark a task as done. I want to make a card as done. For us, the problem there was that cards are not necessarily tasks, and if we made them tasks, then that sort of compartmentalizes what Trello could possibly be and sort of narrows its breadth. And so we struggle with that. I would ask people, like, why can't you just archive the card? And they'd say, no, but I want to see it. And I would say, okay, well, why don't you move it to a list called done? And they'd say, no, like, I you know, like, there was always this, like, going on? So as I drilled down more and more, you could see a pattern, which was, if you actually looked at what people were doing, when people added a due date to a card, if the due date had passed, Trello would make a little badge on the front of the card, which looked like a red bell. It looked like bright red. Yeah. Okay? So when you looked at your board, you noticed it. Okay? But they're like, but I did that thing. And Trello doesn't give me a way to tell it to stop yelling at me because I did it. And I was like, oh, it's actually just like the red color that's bothering them. It's like Trello is causing them anxiety and poking them. And that is the pain that they need to be solved. And when I understood that, it was like, okay, I can bring this down to like a very finite. I don't have to like change the whole system of Trello. I could just focus on that red bell because that is the problem. And like we had a couple different ways of fixing that. Like we had a spec that let you, if you added a due date, you could add a completion date. And so if you didn't have a completion date and it was after the due date, then the bell went red. But if you added a completion date, you know, then it would turn green. But even that felt a little heavy-handed because even the concept of due dates felt too project management-y to me. Like, I almost wish we had just done dates. But one of our developers, like a couple months ago. So this feature's been around for 4 years. So a couple months ago, he came up with this idea and just, like, shipped it. And everyone was just like, oh, right, that's it, that's perfect. Because all he did was he took a due date and he added a checkbox.
Checkbox. I'd noticed this, like, in the past month or so, and it felt so good to be able to check it off.
It's just checkbox, that's it, right? Like, and it's like, it doesn't even make sense because you can't mark a due date as done, right? Like, that doesn't even mean anything, right? Like, the due date's not done, the task is done. But everyone kind of just gets it, and so the requests for that feature just basically went, you know, to zero.
Right?
Because it was like, all I needed was to stop the red, why is Trello yelling at me? Like, I did this thing, like, stop yelling at me. And so that was one of those cases where it was like totally useless to listen to the feature request. And very important to, because like my mission is really like, I think our mission at Trello is really like, it's successful because the on-ramp to figuring out what's going on is so easy and it matches a metaphor that everyone gets, right? They've put sticky notes on a wall. You've used list before. Like, there's not a lot else going on there, okay? And the more abstract concepts that we make in the software, it would make it more powerful, but it would also mean that the learning curve would get more complicated.
Sure.
I'm like, I think about tools like a very vertical tool, like even Jira or Salesforce. There's like, there's all these concepts, right? Like in Salesforce, you've got leads and contacts and opportunities, and that those different things mean different things in the real world, and you have to learn what that means in Salesforce in order to be useful with it. Once you learn
that's
that,
why there's people who like sell Salesforce training, right?
That's right, exactly. But once you learn that, it's super powerful, right? Because if you adopt that preordained workflow, even though you can customize the workflow, you're really adopting this schema. If you adopt that schema into your work life, when you give Salesforce that information and it knows what your data looks like, it can tell you all kinds of amazing things, right? It could be like, hey, your pipeline is way too short.
Yeah.
It's like telling Baremetrics the same stuff, right? Like if you get your data into the right format, I can tell you, oh, you want to know what your magic number is? Like, done. Like, and so you get all these benefits out of that, which you don't get with Trello, because Trello is agnostic about the structure of your data. We let you sort of, it's very fluid and it sort of adopts, but it also, I don't know what your, the card in a certain list, I don't really know if that represents like code that's going out to production or not.
Sure.
Right? I would have to analyze the name of your list and that kind of stuff, but it's not. And so I think about, you know, one of the cool things about Excel was that when you go into Excel, you put your data into the sheet, but you also put your model of how the data relates to itself in the sheet. Mm-hmm. Like when you open up a sheet, it's just blank. It doesn't have a preordained knowledge of how all your data fits together. But as over time, you build it and you change it. Like you add sheets and you delete stuff. And then, and also any old cell, you could just like write a comment. You know what I mean? It doesn't even have to sort of fit in the model that you've defined in another piece of Excel. And I think that's where Excel's power comes from. And that's how I see Trello when you look at processes, right? Like this is about, these are some Lego blocks, you get what a card is, you can make it, you can, you know, get some labels you can play with and people's faces, and there's some checklists and some dates, and you sort of put that stuff together in the way that you think represents this process that you're working on, and then you're done, solved, right?
Yeah, no, that's, I mean, I think it's almost like Excel's the same way in as Trello in this sense. It's almost like a really powerful, like, sheet of paper, you know, like, you just, if you put the data on there and then you define what that data is, and then all of a sudden you can do a lot of powerful things with it.
Yeah.
So Trello's launched 2011, and then in 2014, you guys spun it out from Fog Creek, right?
That was around the time that we hired a CFO at Stack. And so we were also thinking about spinning off Trello because we were running Trello with the profits from selling Fogbugs. And so it was only growing as fast as we could grow according to how much profit Fogbugs was throwing off, right? And we basically had four different things that we wanted to implement, but our dev team was only big enough to do one at a time. Mm-hmm. And we were like, okay, if we have investors that we know from Stack, they're interested in Trello. They see the vision. We could turn around a term sheet in like a day. And
sure.
You know, so let's just, we spun off Stack Overflow. Like we learned our lessons and took our lumps. Like if we do this a second time, we'll probably figure out how to do it a little bit better. And then we were like, but the problem is who's going to run it? Right? Like we had, Joel was running Stack. I was running Fog Creek. And it was like, how do you find someone to like own your baby, right? Like and grow it. And so we struggled with that for a very long period of time. And eventually ended up in the camp of like, okay, I was going to do Trello, and we kind of would collectively, Joel and I would put some of our time into Fog Creek and rely on the managers there to sort of keep it going. Which was kind of okay, but you know, I guess it worked for like a year or two, but it was not the best situation until we just hired Anil Dash as our CEO last year, which was a huge win for us. So
sure. So what was your role? I mean, prior to breaking out Trello into its own entity, like what was your role on Trello, the product?
Oh, good question. I don't remember.
Was it like a project manager or product manager kind of thing?
No, I think I was still just doing the business stuff, like the operations. I think basically that vision, the vision for the product was really Joel's. And he was the product visionary for that. And also the team of people that, the like core team of people that sort of put it together, there were like five people at the company that were, you know, this like group of startup-y people that grew it from, you know, went to TechCrunch Disrupt and launched it on stage and grew it into a product and figured out what to do with it. But I was...
So Joel's mainly focused on like on Stack Exchange, Stack Overflow, right?
Yeah.
I mean, at that point. So was it like you became sort of the default because you were had been the co-founder of Fog Creek, or?
Yeah, I think so. I think in hindsight, you know, like there has you have to have like there's a certain what is the word for it, but like. There's a certain buy-in you need from the employees, right?
Sure. Yeah.
And there's only it's like there's certain people that can take ownership of that. Like because I was the founder of Fog Creek and you know had worked so closely with Stack Overflow, like it was I was able to be the CEO of Trello, even though probably at that time some people were still skeptical of whether I could pull that off, including myself.
Sure.
So, but when you looked around, that was the best choice that we had. Like, it wasn't, there was going to be no one else that showed up that somebody said, oh, right, this person's perfect for taking this startup and this Series A and turning it into a big successful company. So,
what was that transition to CEO like for you? Like, was that a difficult thing or did it kind of feel natural or?
So the pieces of like the operational pieces of the business, like getting the money part working and that part was easy because I had been doing that, right? Like that was really, I totally knew how to get the whole business side of the business set up. I think the biggest challenge for me was for a decade, Joel had been the voice of our products and our company, right?
Like you had been sort of behind the scenes, really.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And so now it was like, oh, there's somebody from the press wants to talk to the CEO of Trello. And I was like, oh, like I have to do it. Like I would have to like be on video or go in front of like on stage. And it's funny because it's the same thing again, right? Like as an entrepreneur, you're like, oh, well, I guess I'll just figure it out. And you just do it. And eventually after you've done it a bunch, you're like, oh yeah, that's not that hard. Right. Like I'm like, if I'm really talking honestly and saying things I believe, then it's easy, right? If I have to put on a show, that might be hard for me because then I would have to like practice and rehearse and know what I was going to say beforehand. But I found like talking to people. Like so, when I go to conferences, I love doing Q&A because it means I don't have to prepare. So sure. I just like get on stage and I'm like, sure, I'll talk about anything. And I think like for me, that works really well with my personality type, and people kind of, I think they like that openness. But so I just, it was, you know, the transition to CEO was first, like, can you be, so the three things the CEO does, this Joel told me, is that you got to keep the vision, right? You got to not run out of money, and you got to hire the best people. And those are, that's it. That's all you do. So, you know, the not run out of money part was pretty easy. I mean, at least I knew the scope of the problem and how to approach it. The hire the best people was, you know, relatively easy given that Trello was so popular and we were hiring people remote. So, like, the recruiting was not that difficult. I think the keeping the vision was the trickiest part and something that I'm still working on now. I think it's pretty easy for me to talk to PR and the press and outwards, but it's, like, sort of being coherent in the story to internally to the company. And, you know, it's easy when it's a group of 10 people and you can sit down and have lunch and everyone's head is in the same place. But once you get past 100, the communication has to be a little bit more, you know, like written communication is much more important. And sort of editing that down and being consistent in what you say. And so it's something I still am perfecting.
You mentioned the vision part. So, I mean, Trello's model from the beginning was to have this huge number of users. I mean, you mentioned 100 million. And then ultimately you charge some smaller percentage of them. So like that 100 million user number, I mean, what was the driving force behind picking that number? Was it the revenue part that would come from charging a small percentage, or was it like this desire to build something that touches the lives of a huge number of people or something else?
I think it was just a big number.
Yeah.
and it was... it set the scale of the thing that we wanted to build.
Sure.
Because if you're trying to get 100 million people, well, one, you have to build a global tool. Like, your software is going to be used globally, right? Like, your market is the world, not right. the U.S., not the English-speaking world, right? Yep. If you want 100 million people using it, you're not going to be able to target just salespeople or just marketers or just HR. Like, you're going to need everyone at a company to be able to see value in your tool, and probably people in their own personal life to see value in your tool. So that was more like setting the stage for like who is our market and where does this tool fit, right?
Yep.
And the 100 million, 1%, $100 million, you know, like those, it's all just, you know, sort of guidelines for, yeah, there's going to be a lot of people that get value out of our product that maybe don't pay us, but we're going to focus on the people that get a ton of value. And the value that we'll get from the other 99%, or whether it's, you know, 97 or 90 sure. or 80, the other percentage will be those people will be fans and advocates for us and continue that growth. Right.
Was there like a singular inflection point where the number of users got really big for you guys? Same for revenue?
No, it just sort of grew like over time. Like, you know, things would happen and you'd get a bump up in new users per week, and then it would just sort of stay there, and then that would get higher. You know, like, for example, like a couple years ago, like Lifehacker wrote a big article about Trello. It was like, it was very long article, and it came out in the new year, which is also a time when people come back to work and want to get organized.
Yep.
And it was sort of this like, boom, we saw, you know, tons of signups. So we naturally see that seasonally, but also because of this article. And so a huge spike in weekly signups. But then when it came back down, it settled at a point that was way higher than previous points. And yep. this is because we have never spent a dollar on acquiring customers, right? We don't do any advertising. We don't do anything to, like, we would do some content marketing. I mean, we employ marketing people. But the people that are coming into Trello are coming because somebody else told them about it. And so if we get more signups, then, you know, that begets more signups, which begets more signups. And, you know, so I don't think there was one point in time. There were just these spikes that you would see, mostly around press or big feature releases that we would do. And then they would just, you know, they'd come back down, but they'd be a little bit higher, and that would just continue to go up. So
was there a day, I mean, you know, whether it's in one of these sort of inflection points, like a Lifehacker article or something else, like was there a specific time you felt like you realized, okay, like this is not just some little tool, like our 100 million user vision actually could work out?
Yeah, there was a couple moments like that. And I think one of them was, so when we launched at TechCrunch Disrupt, we got a pretty, like, we were in this competition. It was called Startup Battlefield, where you could, like, pitch your idea. And then I think Roloff from Sequoia and Marissa Mayer was on stage, and, like, Michael Arrington was on stage. They were, like, judges. And we got to the final round, came in second to this company that, you know, basically ceased to exist after a year. But after that day at TechCrunch Disrupt, our signups, you know, went through the roof, right? This huge yeah. blip on the graph. And, you know, they settled way below that a couple weeks later. And then it grew, right? And it grew and it grew and it grew. And it was like there was a moment where every week we were signing up the number of people that we had sign up during TechCrunch Disrupt. And that was like kind of, when you looked at it, you were like, whoa, like that.
And that became the norm.
Yeah. And you're like, every week is a TechCrunch Disrupt, you know, and then it became every day is a TechCrunch Disrupt, right? Like, and that was, you know, it took a couple of years for that to happen, but it was a big deal.
And then the inverse of that, I mean, was there ever a time that you thought, nope, done, not going to work? I mean, like some epic mistake that felt detrimental or?
No, I think like you whenever, I think competition, it can always like feel very scary. Like when people copy you or when people do something very similar, or you hear about successes that people have, even if you think that they're not anything like you. Like, I think back to, when like Wunderlist got acquired by Microsoft, and it was like, oh no, Microsoft's getting in this game and like they're going to come after us, even though that's a to-do list. And I would like, if anyone called Trello to-do list, I'd like throw some water on them or something. Like, I don't know. Like, that's like that would be the biggest insult I would ever hear. Right. But you know, and today they just discontinued Wunderlist. And, so that was kind of interesting, but you know, there was a lot like over the last year, I think people saw a lot of our success. And so you saw this plethora of people that are building project management tools or adjacent to project management tools would be like, oh, we'll just add the Trello feature, right? Which is, we'll just add boards.
Sure.
Right? And that'll put a stop to Trello. And you know, maybe they're right. I don't know. But I think like, It's a little bit, in one sense you're like, oh, that's kind of scary because that's a lot of people that are adding that feature, but I don't, you spend too much time watching the competition, and I think it distracts you from building an awesome tool.
And I think it makes problems feel bigger than they really are. I mean,
right.
It's sort of a big distraction.
Right.
So last year, you got approached by a little company called Atlassian that wanted to acquire you guys. Like, how did that even come about?
So, I mean, we've been competing with Mike and Scott, the founders of Atlassian, for 13 years. We released Fogbugs back, very early, and they came out with Jira 2 years after that, and for a while, it was like a very, fierce competition, neck and neck, and they plowed a lot of their profits back into the company and grew really quickly. And also, they like I mentioned, that marketing muscle before, they were really good at traditional marketing. And so they grew to be this huge, huge company, IPO. So we, it wasn't this out of the blue contact, I don't know who these people are. But so I think it was either Scott or Mike sent an email to Joel and said that they were going to be in New York and wondering if I was around and I could have lunch. And so I said, sure, I'll meet you for lunch. And this was back in the fall at some point, so like last year in the fall. And I was thinking about raising another round. So we had only done one round of fundraising for Trello, A round. And so I was in the midst of talking to VCs about a B round. But I kind of knew what the conversation was going to be about. But so I sat down with Mike and at this little hole in the wall Mexican joint near our office and had lunch, and we talked about Trello. And it was kind of interesting because all the questions that he asked me were about the vision for the product, like where we wanted to take it, about the culture of the people that were working at the company and the kind of company that we built. And it was like not what I was expecting. You know, here I'm expecting he's going to show up and be like, well, we want to buy your company and here's the offer, here's the numbers, and here's what we think it's worth or whatever. And we literally didn't talk about that at all, such that when I left lunch, I was kind of like, wait, what's that? Were they trying to acquire us? Like, I don't know, because I didn't get any details. But they had done like 18, 19 acquisitions already. A lot of them were smaller than the Trello acquisition, but they had learned a lot from those acquisitions. And I think when they went into this, the things that they knew about, like how successful Trello was successful doing what it was doing. And like, they weren't going to show up and try to tell us to do something different, but also they wanted to make sure that our vision was aligned with their vision. So there was this one moment when he's talking to me and he's like, I sort of talked about the 100 million number. You know, it's like, well, you know, we're trying to build this product for the entire world, and like we want, you know, ever since day one, we've tried to get 100 million customers or 100 million users. And he said, he starts laughing. I thought he was laughing at that number. I was like, wow, how rude. I was like, and he's like, no. He's like, you know, we had this goal internally. We have these big, hairy, audacious goals to, like, you know, focus the company around. Like, a long time ago, we had 60,000 customers. We thought that was a huge number. And he's like, about a year ago, we passed it. And so we had to come up with a new number, a new goal. And so we came up with that we wanted 100 million users to use our product. And he's like, you can go look. It's documented. Like, I swear I wasn't copying you. Like, and it was like, it was a funny moment, but it was also kind of very clear to me that as you sort of dug in, they started their company in the same era that Joel and I started our company. And they started it in a very similar way. They were like almost like our doppelgangers from Australia, you know, like, yep. The way that they built the company, the culture that they built, the values, the way that they treated their people, the goals that they had, and the way that they ran their business. So there was tons of alignment and tons of, like, things where you'd go in and you'd be like, oh, they have this problem. And it's like, yeah, I know exactly why they had that problem. You know, like, I had that same problem. And, like, so it felt very familiar, and it still feels very familiar. And I think like that was one of the biggest, you know, components to this acquisition was like, is this going to let us keep doing what we want to do and build the kind of product that we want to build? And that was a resounding yes. Of course, we also had to make sure that it was going to be a good financial outcome for the employees and the investors and that kind of stuff. But
I can't imagine this was the first time someone had approached you guys about, or at least with some sort of interest in acquiring Trello. I mean, I guess, was it just a sort of this alignment of visions mixed with the right price tag? Or, I mean, were they really the only ones who ever showed, like, legitimate interest? Or
I'll give you a non-answer answer, unfortunately.
Gotcha.
But I think, like, you know, anytime you're in that situation, right, you're running a company, you're trying to build a very valuable company.
Right.
And the way that that value gets expressed can be many different ways. Like, you can get acquired, you can build a great company to work at that pays your salary and a whole bunch of people that you love their salaries, and you could go IPO and extract value that way. You know, so the way that you extract the value is that's not the goal, right? That's just a mechanism. Once you've built something that's really that people see value in, there are multiple ways that you can extract that value. So
sure.
I think the you know, one of the things I think that I thought about was I had done a bunch of reading about people that had sold their companies before, and the things that they did afterwards, and like whether people were happy or not, you know? And one of the things that came up over and over again was that people that start companies, they do it because it's just inside them, right? Like that when they get up in the morning, the way that they, and when they, if they stop doing that, like there were a bunch of people that sold their companies and then went off and traveled the world or something for 6 months. And those people were inevitably always depressed afterwards.
Yep.
They just like lost their purpose, you know? And so for when I thought about this and, you know, thought about the opportunity, like part of it was trying to figure out, like, are we still going to be able to do what we've set out to do, right? Like, is Atlassian going to help us do what we wanted to do? And also, you know, like, is this a good outcome for the people that had invested the company and the employees? And in fact, we had, when we spun off Trello, the cap table for Trello was a copy of the Fog Creek cap table. So everyone that had owned equity over the last decade in Fog Creek had ownership in Trello because of the way that we spun it off. And so, like, this looked like a good outcome. But also, for me, it was really important that these were people that I wanted to work with and that we were going to keep doing what we were doing because I didn't feel like we were even close to being finished.
Sure.
And that felt, you know, like talking to Mike and Scott and just that history and the places that they had been and where they had come from, I felt that alignment. And it just sort of all came together.
So, you know, you've now transitioned to Atlassian. So, I mean, after 15 plus years of building your own companies, I mean, you're essentially now an employee at a public company. So, like, what's the transition been like for you personally? Has that been a hard adjustment or just sort of a non-issue? Or
there's a lot of, so we were a startup, 100 people. Atlassian is a company that does many, many different things, 2,000 people, bigger company. And what we've tried to do is there's a policy in place right now, which is a do not disturb, and trying to let Trello do what it needs to do without slowing it down, right? Like, as I talked about before, about the acquisitions and learning from the previous acquisitions, like, I think that they're adamant that they, you know, do the right things to make sure that Trello's growth continues on the path that it was on. And they would only do things that are going to accelerate the growth, not slow it down. And so, you know, some things are inevitable, right? Like, we got to switch payroll systems and we got to get a new health insurance. And so you go through this period of like, oh, I got to come up to speed on how I submit a health reimbursement, you know, expense or something like that. And so there's that stuff that we had been through. I think the acquisition closed on February 2nd, and now it's been, you know, like 2 months, basically. And I think we're coming through that. But generally, day to day, not much has changed for pretty much for most of the people at the company.
I mean, you guys are still same offices and everything, right?
Like, yeah. Gotcha. Yeah. And they've been very clear to make sure that the streams of, you know, that, like, you know, sometimes you get the best intentions, like the people in Atlassian get the best intentions and want to help and want to, like, really excited about helping and learning. But the problem is there's 10 of them for every one of us, or actually there's 20 to one. And so you can just get overwhelmed. And so it's sort of like you have to do these things very slowly. And I think we're benefiting from the fact that they've done these acquisitions before and learned so many different lessons from that. So yeah. I think day to day, you know, it hasn't really changed that much. I mean, I might use different tools or I might submit my reimbursement in a different way. But as far as like building the features for Trello and what we're going to do in the future, it's the same as it was 6 months ago.
So to wrap things up, like, what do you feel like the future holds for Trello now that maybe, I mean, is it any different than it was sort of pre-Atlassian? I mean, the 100 million user goal sounds like it's actually still probably the same, but
yeah.
Has anything otherwise changed as far as end goals?
I think one thing that's changed is, you know, I said keep the vision, recruit really good people, don't run out of money. The don't run out of money part becomes a lot easier.
Right.
So, like, it's way easier for us to, you know, if our burn was like, you know, 250 grand and we had, you know, $2 million left in the bank, it's like, okay, well, we only got 8 months of runway, right? And it's like, in a $6 billion company, if they want to spend $10 million in investment, it's like, okay, let's, you know, we just decide to do that. So it changes the sort of dynamics around that piece, right? So it's much more strategic. You're like, you're not worried about like, hey, can I just, you know, keep going for 3 more months so I can get better numbers so when I go to the VCs, I have better charts so I don't get as much dilution. Sure. I get a value. You know, it just takes that piece out of the equation. It's like, well, what do we want to do? What can we do? What's going to move the needle the most? And let's focus on that.
Cool. That sounds awesome. Well, that's all I've got, Michael. Thanks for hopping on a call, man.
Thanks, Josh.
There we have it, Michael Pryor of Trello. Thanks for listening this week. If you need revenue analytics and insights, check out baremetrics.com. If you have any feedback, I would love to hear it. Shoot me an email, josh@baremetrics.com, or on Twitter @Spigford. Head to founderchats.com to listen to a heaping pile of other conversations with startup founders. And if you enjoyed this, a rating on iTunes or sharing with your friends really does go a long way. Thanks again, and see you next week.